I'm against things, but I won't tell you what I'm against.
Tonight, I need you guys to hug it out. I need you guys to love it out.
Thank you, New Hampshire, for giving us our first great victory.
Well, I know her, and she'd make a good president or a good vice president.
People were walking around both floors of our office trying to catch Pokemon.
And we have banned Pokemon Go here from the studios of WNPR. You're not allowed to do it here, but you're allowed to do other things, and the Wheelhouse will be doing some of those things today. John Dankosky's not here. We don't really know for sure, but there's this nascent Dan Haar for governor in 2018 campaign, and I think Dankosky may be being vetted for a running mate. That's just a rumor. It's a political rumor. I don't have that confirmed yet. So anyway, he's not here. I'm attempting to host in his behalf. Kevin Rennie is joining us, attorney, Hartford Current columnist, former Republican, state lawmaker. Tom Dudzik, the founder and editor of ctcapitalreport.com. They're both in studio with me. And down in our New Haven studios is Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. We're going to just quickly begin by turning our eyes to Dallas and turning our memories to yesterday. It's one of the dominating news stories of the last week. But yesterday's memorial service at Dallas might have been a little bit different from what people thought. First of all, with President Barack Obama sharing the stage with former President George W. Bush. Let's hear first from President Obama.
Now, I'm not naive. I have spoken at too many memorials during the course of this presidency. I've hugged too many families who've lost a loved one to senseless violence. And I've seen how a spirit of unity born of tragedy can gradually dissipate.
Let's hear from President Bush as well. He's also speaking about unity.
We do not want the unity of grief. Nor we want the unity of fear. We want the unity of hope, affection, and high purpose.
Kalila Brown-Dean, I'm going to start with you. I mean, obviously, we do need words about unity. We do need soothing words. Was yesterday in Dallas, was that what we needed?
I think that yesterday was such an important speech. It was a provocative speech, but it reminded me of the speech that President Obama, then candidate Obama, gave in Philly in 2008. To be able to say, yes, we mourn the lives of these officers. We should protect our law enforcement. We should reject that kind of hatred on every level. But to say that it's also the same time that a country is mourning the deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile in Minneapolis, I thought that was bold and it was important. So it wasn't just unity in the sake of this kumbaya, let's hold hands, sing the battle hymn of the Republic, and let George W. Bush dance while doing it. But unity is about action and about deed across lines. And that's why I think yesterday was so important.
You know, Kevin Rennie, some people heard in the words of both men, and perhaps President Bush would be the bigger surprise, kind of a dig at Donald Trump. You know, kind of there was a lot of talk about how we're all one family in this country and we've got to be together. I think it was Bush who used that word family about what America is. And I don't know. Did you hear it that way? Did you hear that as the yesterday's speeches as kind of an attempted antidote to the politics of division?
I think that George W. Bush spoke the way he would have spoken him if he had been president 8 years ago, if this had happened then. And so I think he would have said those things. And it's just the atmosphere, particularly for a former Republican president who has borne, you know, without saying very much, he has borne a lot of ugly criticism from Donald Trump. I think it's probably the natural reaction for the rest of us is to think that's got to be on his mind when he's speaking, because we don't hear from him very often.
Right. And Tom Dudzik, that's one of the oddities of Donald Trump, is that you can be making sort of a basic kind of plea for the family of humanity. And it seems like it's a rebuke of Donald Trump.
I think I think a lot of people, when you look at the speech, when you heard both of those presidents and you hearken back to Ronald Reagan's speech after the Challenger incident, you know, you realize that that was missing now in this current debate in America between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is this kind of soothing speech, of a speech that makes us come together as opposed to what tears us apart. So I mean, I think it was a unique speech, and I think it will be one of those speeches that we'll be talking about in years to come.
And although Kalilah, you know, over the weekend there was a piece in the New York Times about whether either one of these presidential candidates would really have the capacity to do this. I mean, it's a mystery. We don't really know the answer to this until one of them gets elected. But, you know, could the country come together behind either one of these two potential presidents who have such high negatives, who are so divisive, who seem we've talked about this before on this show. Mm-hmm. They have historically high net negatives. You know, on a day like this, let's hope there aren't too many more of them, but on a day like yesterday, in future years, would either one of these people be able to, I don't know, get America in one place?
Well, I think the sad reality is that there will be more days like this. I think, you know, less than a month ago when we were talking about the Orlando nightclub shooting, we didn't think that it would be so soon that we had to lower the flags half staff because of a national day of mourning. And yet here we are. So if I think about the speeches that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump gave after Orlando and some of the other tragedies that have occurred, sadly, in these last 6 months, I don't know that either of them has the presence to have that kind of soothing voice that still pushes all Americans to say we can do better. So we can support our law enforcement while still letting young people know that when they see police, they shouldn't feel fear. They should feel safety. I was trying to imagine yesterday what it would have sounded like if Donald Trump had given that address yesterday. And it was frightening because I think that the energy that people needed to feel affirmed, to feel a part of an America, even if it was just for the 10 minutes of that speech, I'm not sure that would happen.
And I don't think you can imagine a Donald Trump making that speech because he hasn't made that speech before. And despite the fact that all his advisors for months have been telling him to try to be presidential, he mocks that. And I tell my friends that, you know, when the bodies come home to Dover Air Force Base, I can't imagine a Donald Trump standing there, you know, with families. You can't.
Well, you know, Kevin, not to necessarily gainsay anything that was just said, but sometimes the office shapes the person, too. There's something about going in there, sitting behind that desk, picking up those pens.
Sometimes the moment and the office do combine, yeah. But the person in the office matters, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the ability to do that. And it'd be very hard to imagine him, you know, whether it's a natural weather-related tragedy or human tragedy, a creative tragedy. It's just very hard to imagine him somehow suspending his narcissism in order to deliver a speech that is unifying and soothing and uplifting.
Although maybe there would be an announcement prior to that, say from the White House, saying President Trump has announced he will suspend his narcissism for the next 8 hours. You know, we'd all know. We'd be on alert.
It's kind of like one of those code reds. You know, they had different shades. You know,
we could still call it code red. Actually, all right, we're going to actually leapfrog from there to perhaps more nakedly political considerations, but unity nonetheless, because yesterday also Bernie Sanders joined Hillary Clinton on stage in New Hampshire to make an announcement that either felt inevitable or impossible, depending on how hard you feel the burn. Here's Bernie.
She must become our next president.
So, you know, yesterday I was at this farmer's market that I go to in the West End of Hartford, and one of the farmers is this guy. I mean, you talk to all the farmers, and I talk to this guy every week. And he sort of said to me, I hope I'm quoting him close to accurately. He goes, you know, if it wasn't so busy right now, I'd ask you, maybe you could tell me sometime, what am I supposed to do now with all my Bernie loyalty? And I said, well, I thought he told you. He just told you today exactly what to do with your Bernie loyalty. So, Kalilah, you know, I mean, one of the questions was, I mean, there are all these sort of leading up to that moment, all these questions, like there was almost like an enthusiasm meter that had to be put on, like, does he sound enthusiastic enough to bring his people with him? How do you think the day went yesterday?
Well, I think it's interesting looking at how his supporters responded, of some people saying, oh, I feel nauseous, and I'm sure that he did too. And I kind of chuckled. chuckled because I thought at the end of the day, Bernie Sanders is a politician who has been in elected office for years and understands how this process works. So whether it happened yesterday or it happened 2 months ago, we knew that this was coming. But I also think it speaks to the fundamental problem often for American voters is that we become so invested in candidates and in personalities that we don't take a step back to focus on the issues and the policy. That's where we have to go. So whether it's Bernie Sanders or it's the political party that you align with, at some point they'll disappoint you because they have their own path as well. So I think the messaging yesterday for Sanders was less about vote for Hillary Clinton and more about vote against Donald Trump. We've seen that in Connecticut elections as well.
So the other place, Tom Dudzik, that things like this happen are conventions. I was either both sort of disturbed, appalled, and delighted to read that some Bernie supporters are still planning a flatulence act at the convention where they will all eat beans before they going in there, as many beans as they can put in their little mouths, and then just cut loose, I guess, when Hillary Clinton is giving her acceptance speech, which, thank you, Bernie bros, never change. It's so good to know that you're still who you are. But flatulence notwithstanding, you know, the convention is the other place where the pageantry of Bernie Sanders endorsing Clinton, it's got to work, right? The stagecraft's got to work in a way that really does send that signal.
Yeah, and of course, an addendum to that, they're going to have bean feeding stations in close proximity to the convention as well.
So you get your last little dose of beans on your way in.
One more mouthful of beans. But of course, I'm still waiting to see when Governor Malloy's spot is going to be at the convention. But you know, it'll be well staged. Imagine anyone who watched that Clinton standing next to Bernie Sanders yesterday. It was like a hostage tape. She's like nodding her head and clapping her hands, going, "Get me out of here! Get me out of here! Because it's over yet."
Kevin is very upset about the beans.
He spent a lot of – Bernie Sanders yesterday spent a lot of time – before he got to that endorsement part, he spent a lot of time recapping his own campaign mm-hmm. and his many victories. And also that he mentioned he's going to be nominated on the – and I was surprised. Usually when you endorse another candidate –
I think that was part of the deal. I think that was part of the negotiations. I think he wants to be placed in nomination. Obviously Kennedy was placed in nomination in 80, right? I think
he didn't. He had not endorsed Jimmy Carter
Okay, so there you go. You know, each one of these things is a little different. They're different. All snowflakes.
A little different, yes. Yeah. It was in the lead up to that endorsement, it was uncomfortable viewing. It was uncomfortable.
It really was.
I carry no brief for Hillary Clinton, but I thought, gee, she's smiling inappropriately at all sorts of places because it's hard to stand there and sort of nod when your opponent who you vanquished is talking about all the time, CPU.
One of the questions that I have, and since we have an authentic political scientist here, I can ask her, is so one of the, like, go back to the farmer guy I was talking to yesterday, young guy, you know, what am I supposed to do? Well, one answer that some Bernie supporters have is Gary Johnson, that Hillary Clinton is antithetical to them, to everything that they've ever stood for. For some reason or other, the Green Party doesn't seem to attract them. I don't know why. It seems a little bit more consonant with, you know, with what Bernie Sanders stood for. But a lot of people are talking about Gary Johnson, and which is, I don't know how you can go from somebody as big government as Bernie essentially has to be. I mean, to be a democratic socialist, you've got to a libertarian who, at least theoretically, at the level of political science, has to be about as small government as you can possibly be. How can such a thing happen?
Well, you know, I'm all for civic education. And this, again, is a sign of why we need to do more of this. The kinds of policy proposals that Bernie Sanders has put forth looks nothing like what Gary Johnson is advocating. And even listening to Sanders' speech yesterday, right? So Secretary Clinton wants to expand access to higher education for families that make less than $125,000. She wants to expand access to healthcare. This is what Bernie Sanders is saying about why people should support him. That is not what Johnson is saying on any level. So if, in fact, you want to vote for someone because you do not feel that you can vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you might as well, you know, insert the name of your favorite Pokemon character, because their views are probably closer to what you want and what Bernie Sanders believes than Gary Johnson.
Well, those Pokemon characters get great health care.
If we could put them at the polling place, maybe we'll have higher turnout. Who knows?
We should all be included in their plan. All right. I'm going to just leap in yet another. Actually, I want to do a lightning round. I want to do a lightning round where we cover the most pointless political story, national political story in every presidential cycle, which, of course, is running mates. So, Kevin Rennie, I'm going to go to you first. Your guess for a Hillary Clinton running mate, your guess for a Trump. Trump is talking about maybe on Friday going with his running mate choice. So take your wild guess in this.
Castro? Yes.
The Julian as opposed to
yes.
Not Raul, right?
Correct.
All right. So
no, they've already elevated Raul Castro in the last few years, so they don't need to make him vice president.
So Clinton picks Castro, Trump picks who?
I think he's going to pick Pence. I do. Mm-hmm. Although I'm thinking I wouldn't rule out Newt Gingrich because there's something about the bloviator in Newt Gingrich that I'm sure he finds attractive. Trump.
All right, Dudchik, you've had time to gather your wits.
I would go with Castro too, and I would say Newt. I think that it is a very strange ticket, but somehow I think that Trump looks at Newt and says, I love this guy. You can see him up there together.
How is it ever not going to be a strange ticket? I mean, who could he pick where
it has to be?
Wouldn't be a strange ticket. All right, Kalilah, you get the final guess here.
So political scientists don't forecast, but I will say I don't think it should be Julian Castro because I think he has such a bright future on his own. Going in as a VP at this stage won't help him.
All right. Is that all you're prepared to say? How about Trump? Give us the parameters for Trump, or is there just no way to put yourself inside the mind of this man?
How about Ivanka? No, I think that Pence and Gingrich are definitely the two. I think that Pence helps shore up that evangelical vote, that very conservative, not just Republican in name, but true Republican vote. Looking at the party's platform, that's what makes sense.
All right. I want to exercise my my host prerogative and instead of my guess about Clinton's running mate, say who I want. And I actually think it would be a good idea. I'm not the first person to come up with this. Al Franken. Al Franken would be such a great running mate for Hillary Clinton, particularly because, he's sort of an entertainer. I mean, he has kind of a background in all this stuff. She's running against a guy who's essentially an entertainer. And there's all sorts of other ways in which Al Franken works, and he's sort of essentially likable, too. So I have no clue. I'm on the Gingrich front just because I don't know, Kevin, I feel like Pence is sort of another snarling dog, in a way that he too closely resembles.
He also represents everything that Donald Trump said he was against.
Right. Well, why should that
That's
stop
always
anybody?
Tricky in a vice president. I was thinking what must the vetting process in the Trump campaign about? Certainly, you can't ask them for their income taxes. You can't say, did you say this once?
No, you have to prove that you said intemperate things.
Were you for me or were you against me?
Yeah.
So, speaking of sort of being for things or against things and whether you believe the same things as the person at the top of your ticket, let's quickly talk platforms. So, Kalilah, a lot of times this is the moment when the primaries are over and the general election begins that parties start kind of sculpting their platforms in a way that's a little bit more centrist, a little bit more appealing to a multiple of people. But the Republicans seem to be struggling with this. I mean, as they head into Cleveland, they've got sort of a destroy ISIS, build the wall, get more religion into the law. Overturning the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. It's sort of there's kind of heading into Cleveland with a game plan that doesn't once again seem like it's framed in a way that would speak to a whole lot of, say, unaffiliated voters.
I think if we look at the platforms for both parties, we get a sense of why a vigorous debate during the primaries is so important for shaping the party platform and shaping the priorities. So if you look at the DNC platform, you can see that Bernie Sanders influence of the party saying that they are now going to oppose the death penalty, that they want to protect civil rights, protect access in ways that the candidate didn't necessarily agree with going into the primary. Republicans are really closing ranks when you look at the platform. And it goes against everything we thought we learned after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, of the RNC saying we have to increase support with the LGBTQ community, with women, with minorities, ethnic and racial minorities, and working class people. Nothing in that platform says we need to do more than just have the voters we've always had. There's so many independents voting in November. You have to rethink that position.
Kevin, it was suggested yesterday, I don't know if this is definite or not, that Nigel Farage may be speaking in Cleveland or at least attending the convention. That's the thing. I mean, this convention, partly because all Bushes are staying away, a lot of governors and senators are staying away. I mean, it runs the risk of turning into this kind of
freak show.
can they afford to have that happen?
A year ago, I think I could have given you an answer that would have said no, that would have been terrible. This is so crazy that I don't know what damages them anymore, because we're sitting here on Wednesday morning and the Quinnipiac poll came out this morning on swing states, and Donald Trump is beating. I mean, I know it's just a poll, but mm-hmm. still, we use it as some measure, beating Hillary Clinton in important places. And it is very unsettling. Very, very unsettling.
Tom, as we head into these conventions, too, it seems as though the parties structurally have sort of the exact opposite problems. You know, the Democrats are some large portion of the Democrats, the Bernie-crats, are saying, you know what, this party is too hierarchical. Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Clintons kind of, you know, set up this kind of path to victory that was mildly disrupted by Bernie. They didn't see that coming. But in general, you know, there isn't as much freedom of choice as there ought to be. There's too many superdelegates. And the Republicans, I've talked to a lot of Republicans saying, you know, we ought to get ourselves more of them damn superdelegates. You know, we can't control this process. We have this lunatic running for president that we didn't even want in the first place. It's odd, but each one of these parties is kind of facing the opposite problem.
It is, and I think it'll come to head in on national television during these conventions. And, you know, going back to the platform, I mean, many people have, as one pundit on the television this morning, called the Republican platform the Tony Perkins platform, for his fingerprints are all over in many ways. And many people say that Donald Trump just abdicated the whole platform. He said, listen, you guys take care of that. You know, no one cares about it anyways. So the question will be, is that, you know, will this be the first year that these platforms even make a difference?
Well, I don't think platforms have made a difference in a long time. I think that they get some attention for this month when they're created, but then they fade away.
Governor Malloy would part company with you on that one, huh?
Well, yeah. I would part company with him on many things. It would be a minor one.
If we had more time, first of all, I would love to talk about, I mean, Howard Dean is already now criticizing Governor Malloy about the Cigna Anthem merger and saying, you know, how can you be head of the platform committee if you're dragging that thing to Philadelphia with you? I will say, Tom, that I think the big question is which Tony Perkins, right? The family conservative activist or psycho? We have to take a break. We'll come back. All right. Welcome back to The Wheelhouse. I'm Colin McEnroe. John Dankosky's usually sitting in this seat, but he's busy right now. Part of the kitchen cabinet for the Danny Haar for Governor 2018 campaign. Their beta slogan, Explain America Great Again. Joining me instead is Kevin Rennie, attorney, Hartford Courant columnist, and Republican state lawmaker. Tom Dudchick, editor of ctcapitalreport.com, pretty much the gateway to all political news in the state of Connecticut. Kalila Brown Dean's down in our New Haven studios, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. It's actually not even on my list of things to talk about, but we can't not talk about this. I feel like the political climate of Connecticut is a desert if Susan Bisowitz isn't doing at least something. She has to be doing at least something. So, Tom, what is she doing now?
She's a bundler for Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was my friend from the Hearst newspaper, Neil Vigder, reported that she has bundled over $250,000 in small number denominations to send to the Hillary campaign, and that has gotten her a special ticket, like, you know, Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory, to the Democratic National Convention. So
She's on the finance committee, right? She's back.
She was, however, unable to win a seat as a delegate in the Connecticut delegation, which I think is important to remember.
You're so obsessed with winning, Kevin. Kevin, you're so obsessed with winning. Let that go.
And they have plenty of delegate spots in the Connecticut delegation, Democratic delegation.
Bison was 18. Here she comes, baby.
Kalila, there's, you know, I have this sort of basic belief that everywhere in America on any given night, you know, every rock band that you ever heard growing up is playing somewhere, even if they just have the drummer left or something. That, you know, Quicksilver Messenger Service has a gig at some casino somewhere in the Southwest tonight. And it is sort of like politicians really never go away, right?
Not at this level. I mean, if you can bundle $250,000 for a candidate, why would you go away? Why would they let you go away? So, but it does raise the question, will she be relegated to the status of being bundler in chief, or will she emerge as a candidate again and be successful?
I like how many times we've said various derivations of the word bundle in this one very short conversation. We like saying bundle, particularly with Susan Bisowitz. All right, we have to move on. This is Kevin's favorite story. These would be the UConn salaries. These were rather large salary bumps, extremely large salary bumps, I'm comfortable saying, for part of the administrative inner circle of UConn president Susan Herbst at a time when budgets are being cut right and left. And these are not people who deliver classroom services. These are lawyers and architects and people like
that.
Chiefs of staff and stuff like that. So you columnized about it.
Yes.
Why don't you take the lead here?
Well, they had contracts with some of these upper echelon UConn officials who are longtime state skillful bureaucrats, and they gave them huge salary increases. And you have to ask yourself, would they have left those jobs if they hadn't gotten those salary increases? And the answer is no, because as I said, they are longtime state employees. They have tremendous pensions that are awaiting them. And these big salary increases have disproportionate I shouldn't say disproportionate because it's the state system, but they have a profound effect on their pensions. And so these raises mean millions of dollars over the fullness of time to these people. Millions. That's money that, you know, will not be going to other services.
Right. In fact, to Kevin's point, Tom, in some of the reporting, I haven't had a chance to talk to Rich Orr or anybody else who's getting one of these raises about this. And we should say that some of them backed off, at least on parts of the raises, right, after a wave of bad publicity and especially withering Kevin Rennie column.
Though not Larry McHugh, the
Chairman of the board.
Chairman of the board who has just lost his way. He really has.
But Tom, it wasn't even clear to me whether those people even knew they were supposed to get these raises. No. It almost seemed like one of those Monopoly cards you turn over.
Well, I think if you read the reporting, I think that it was promised to them years ago, and these are kind of like step increases. But, you know, I mean, can we just get over the whole pay raise increase? I know it's a dog on a bone with Rennie and this kind of stuff, but, you know, we pay legislators paltry amounts of money. But yet, here we are at the University of Connecticut, our state university, which is basically revered across the state of Connecticut for many things, you know, not to mention its sports team, you know, and to keep good people, you have to pay them.
No, they would stay. You would not have to give them these raises because they're already making a lot of money into the future with the benefits that they get. And also, it's important to remember, UConn has the highest administrative costs in the nation for public university.
And certainly a few years ago, Bloomberg News was doing a story about administrative bloat at colleges, and I think Purdue was ahead of us. But other than that, I mean, really, the salaries, Tom, are incredible. And Kalila, it does bring up the question, sort of, UConn is neither quite fish nor fowl, right? It doesn't really feel exactly like a state agency the way the Department of Transportation or the Department of Corrections is, but it is in some other ways, obviously, part of state government. It falls within the rubric of state government. What Susan Herbst seems to be doing, though, is saying at a time when we're, you know, laying off all kinds of people who deliver services to people in great need, I have money somehow to give people who already make a hell of a lot of money and are going to get gigantic pensions and aren't really delivering services to any student.
So I think what we've heard over the last few months across the state in our sort of current budget crisis is this emphasis on shared sacrifice, that we're all going to have to give up some things for the good of our state and to keep things going. So even if the president has this discretionary money to allocate, which I think university officials should have, when you have parents that are now setting up GoFundMe accounts so that they can raise money to pay their kids' tuition in the fall, this is perhaps not the time to say we believe in shared sacrifice for some but not for all, especially when you look at those young people who we've been telling for years the best way to get ahead in this state is to get a good education and then stay here. So even if those wages were promised and people should get what they were promised, where we are right now makes it a very difficult sell for parents, for families, and for the students and staff at those universities.
That was such a nicely done answer. I hope Hillary Clinton has you on a short list for diplomats. Yes. She should get a really good.
Why not Trump? You know, yeah. Why not Trump? No, Trump, yes, don't pigeonhole
Trump. Especially Trump.
Trump's giving you nothing.
Rennie's classic line about UConn, he has famously called them the fourth branch.
Fourth branch of government. Mm-hmm. Yes, the one that is unregulated.
The branch we're being beaten with right now.
It's important to remember that a lot of state employees didn't get what was promised them because they 5 years ago they went and they renegotiated contracts under duress, reopened them, and changed all sorts of things such as when you could retire. Mm-hmm. That changed the course of, you know, certainly for 5 years course of people's lives. But UConn is largely immune to that.
And Susan Herbst seems exceptionally tenured about a lot of these kinds of issues. I mean, it has been one of the hallmarks of her tenure is that she often seems to be saying things that are drastic.
Well, I think she's tasked by the governor and her board of trustees in building a major university.
Well, you're in the tank.
I'm not in the tank. Someone has to, you know, someone has to kind of like play the opposite side here.
Make it up? No.
She pays somebody like $250,000 a year to do that.
At least two people.
Tyson Kendig or whatever his name is.
Listen, if we're going to go after UConn, there's plenty of other low-hanging fruit around people who are making a lot of money and probably don't deserve it around here too. So,
all right. So let's go look at some other low-hanging fruit.
I think Colin earns every dollar he makes.
I really do, actually. Yes. I really do.
I don't think that's very nice.
Their budget meeting is the empty loose change out of their pockets and dive for it.
You know too much, Tom. All right. So speaking of low-hanging fruit, we'll just do a real quick visit to the State Bonding Commission where there's a lot of sniping going back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. This has to do in particular with kind of, this sort of sense that the pocketbook is empty. And now the pocketbook is empty. We're using the charge card after the pocketbook is empty. That's what the Bonding Commission does. But, you know, Kevin, as a former state legislator, you've got to feel like, I mean, at least for me, maybe I'm kind of old-fashioned about bonding. I think it's for, like storm improvements, you know.
Yeah, you are full debt. You're old-fashioned. You're old-fashioned.
I think it's for infrastructure.
It should be. It should be. It has, because of the budget issues, and it's become another way of paying for things that used to be in the yearly general budget. And sort of my moment was when I saw that not too long ago, they're bonding $10 million for the Connecticut Science Center. I thought, you know, if you're going to convince the public of this, the urgency of the state finances, which they're starting to see on their own, you just can't keep doing things like that. And I don't think that reality has been applied to our state bonding practices. We're bonding ridiculous things.
So, Dudchuk, one of the things that happens in this situation is that you have Republicans, leveling somewhat legitimate criticism about the way that this is being done. On the other hand, not really able to, you know, take their own heads out of the trough, right?
They can't push themselves away from the table. Here's poor Len Fasano out there sending press releases off saying he was thrilled to get $500,000 in bonding for bleachers and a concession stand in October. And yet, ahead of this bond agenda, he's out there saying how bad this is and it's putting our families in deficits for years. I made one point many, many moons ago when I worked for Weicker, the bond commission agenda was a half a page. The meetings lasted less than 5 minutes, and if I was late for it, he was coming back to the office ready because we had no money. And the Weicker said no bonding, said no to everything.
Well, now the meetings are often quite brief because everything gets put in, a lot of things get put in an omnibus package.
Yes.
So there's like statues and things
favor,
like that.
One measure, this is when I get a message from someone by phone or email saying, "Oh, check out the bond agenda." I think, "Oh my God, there's a half hour. I'm going to have to go through that bond agenda and find what the person is referring to, because it is in many ways its own language, and it's intended
right.
that way."
Right. Yeah. No, it's not intended to be scrutable. So, but Kalilah, we're back to the same problem, which is everybody wants to go to heaven. Nobody wants to die.
I love your references, but how do I follow that up, Colin? I don't know. But I think it goes back to sort of a theme we've been talking about for a long time. Everyone thinks the system is corrupt unless it's working for them. And so even if the critiques are legitimate, I think, as others have said, when you are benefiting from it so that you can then go back and tell your voters, look, I criticized the way that we do this, but I brought this back for you, then the voters are kind of placated to say, OK, you're right. Let's wait until we can get something else. Fundamental problem is that this is not sustainable for our state. And until we recognize that and come up with an alternative, we'll always be right back here.
All right. Well, we'll be right back here after this break. We're going to take a quick break so we have time for a robust discussion of a few more issues. Welcome back to The Wheelhouse. This is Colin McEnroe. I want to also mention that you can comment at WNPR.org, where this show will go up later today, I assume. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We'd love to have you tweet your thoughts about today's show. We're going to move out of the political sphere, but not entirely out of the political sphere, to a story down in New Haven that's exciting quite a bit of comment. Yesterday, former Yale employee Corey Menefee was in New Haven Superior Court after he knocked out a stained glass window at a Yale dining hall that depicted slaves in a cotton field. Here is one of his supporters, West Haven community activist Barbara Fair.
Breaking the window was not right, but neither is that racist environment. It's not right either. Yale needs to come forth and apologize for subjecting people to those kind of environments every single day that they come in and work for them.
All right. So, Kalilah Brandine, this is a story that you've been following closely. The comments at the Paul Bass's New Haven Independent were so fast and furious they had to shut them down rather than having the server crash. So where are you on this story?
Well, I think it is a tragic turn of events. The idea that this man is now facing a felony charge for this. What he did in terms of, you know, breaking the window and destroying that property is not right. But the idea that he will now possibly have a felony conviction, which has a lifetime impact on him and his family, that is also wrong. So what we're talking about here in this national conversation is about justice, and the just is proportional. This is not that case. And so if you know that there is such a contentious past associated with that name and with that image, then you protect and affirm your employees. You don't then subject them to this and expect that they will just go along with it because it's there. This has sparked off something that is much greater than a window and much deeper than just what's happening here in New Haven.
And we should say the window in question is at Calhoun College. The name of Calhoun College, it's named after John C. Calhoun, has been a subject of great contention over the years and became an even greater subject of contention after last year's events in Charleston. I was one of the people writing in Salon who started to once again ask questions about this question. Questions that I, as a person who attended that university, never really asked at the time that I was there. On the other hand, I mean, Kalilah, just one thing that we should say. I mean, Yale has said that they really aren't interested in having Corey Menefee prosecuted at all under those circumstances and given prosecutorial discretion and stuff like that. I mean, really, the likelihood that he's facing a felony charge strikes me as very, very low.
Well, I think that the fact that it's even on the table is a problem. This is something that could have been handled internally. We know that happens all the time when students behave poorly or when faculty do things that are questionable. This could have been handled internally. So if in fact it is true that he was given the option of leaving or that he voluntarily resigned from his position, it could have ended there, but it wasn't. So even if he's not convicted, even if this does not proceed further, he will have a very difficult time getting a job beyond this incident. So it's not just about personal responsibility. It's also about institutional accountability.
So one of the things that we do know, Kevin Rennie, is I mean Yale has said that they already kind of had a plan to get these windows out. I think you can legitimately fault Yale University for being slow, right? They've known for a long time they've had a problem.
Very, very slow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also, it's an interesting point about how there are plenty of things go on college campuses that never get reported to the police. Mm-hmm. That if the same thing happened off campus, would certainly be under the eye of the police. So when the college administration does report things to the police, you know that they're going an extra step more than they usually take. And I know Yale is a very tough place when it comes to their administration and the way they treat people.
But normally they do handle these issues with a more deft hand. I mean, you know, they've done it in the past, and so to me it seems odd that normally the response would be to a university like Yale would be, yes, we recognize this was a symbol that was in the workplace that shouldn't be there. We acknowledge that he probably shouldn't have done that, but it helped us to see how wrong this was. In the same light that someone pointed out in Paul Bass's story that the anti-Semitic symbols and imagery would certainly not be tolerated in the workforce and in that light as well too. So I have to like question how Yale's handling this as well.
Well, you know, I mean, I'll just say this, that I think Peter Salovey, the president of Yale, has been walking a very complicated line. And from the point of view of pressure he's getting from big donors who are older, who remember a very different Yale, I mean, I think they see him as a guy who's been a little on the wishy-washy side quite apart from what Kevin has just said, a guy who really, you know, needed to take the reins more last year during the time of campus unrest, where, you know, people see these videos on YouTube where students are surrounding the head of Silliman College and yelling the F word at him, and sort of nothing gets done about that, not even an apology. So, you know, Kalila, a president of a college, is answerable to all kinds of different constituencies. And I know that Salovey is hearing it, you know, from older alumni sort of saying, well, I mean, you can't not have any rules that you enforce. I completely agree that this seems like something that could have been dealt with internally. But I wonder if Yale's zigging and zagging because they can't find a straight course to steer on this.
Well, I think that no matter what decision they make, there's going to be someone who is upset or offended by that decision. There are people who say this is a remarkable university, a world-class university that is built on history and tradition. And we shouldn't release that history and tradition just because some people feel uncomfortable with it. We can't erase that history. But students are saying history has its place and it has a context. So if you're going to have world-class museums and galleries, then place that history within those galleries and those museums, not in a place where students, faculty, staff are reminded every day of that time when they were not viewed as equal, of that time when they couldn't have even been students there. You know, let's more become top-level administrators. So I think Salovey is in a very difficult position, but I think he is an amazing leader that now has the opportunity to lead the correct way on this.
Yeah, I do think, first of all, that they had an opportunity to talk, to really get into the idea of changing the name of Calhoun College. They elected not to. And they sort of, you know, they've said all along they'd rather use it as a teaching tool, which, I don't know, just a teaching tool for, and, you know, John C. Calhoun's name on a residential college of Yale. That's a really big teaching tool. You better be teaching all the time about it. And,
right.
And on the other hand, I don't think we want a society where if you don't like something, you smash it, right? Because, you know, even if it's really offensive, if you don't like it, you smash it. Because, look, there are conservative Christian young people who are really offended by, you know, LGBT commemorations or statues or monuments. We don't want them feeling like, well, as a matter of conviction, I'm going to smash this thing because the Bible tells me it's wrong.
We had this moment last year when Bree Newsom scaled the flagpole in Charleston, South Carolina to remove the Confederate flag, right? So when the values of your institution or of your state are this higher calling to God, to country, to Yale, to put forth these views and these values, you need to make sure that every symbol, every name is in accordance with those values. That's how you sustain tradition, but it's also how you set the standard.
We're going to move on a little bit because I know that Kevin Rennie wants to talk about a place where, you know, they know how to sort of do leadership changes in a way that just it barely attracts any notice. So Great Britain, obviously, David Cameron misplayed his hand with Brexit, bet all of his chips on a referendum that went the other way. Let's hear a final few words out of David Cameron.
Other than one meeting this afternoon with Her Majesty the Queen, the diary for the rest of my day is remarkably light.
So they certainly do know how in a very cheery way to get themselves out of the picture. But, I mean, obviously we now have a new prime minister coming in. You know, it's almost hard if you're not British to figure out how this even happens.
Oh, I think even if you are British, the last few weeks have been difficult to sort of figure out. It's going to make for great drama when ultimately it is turned into that in terms of the stage and film that, you know, some of the big players of a month ago are gone.
So do you wish – I mean, well, we meanwhile have had this 18 to 24
yes,
month
it has
horror
occurred to
show.
Me. I know, I am a small D Democrat, but it has occurred to me that there are some lessons to be learned from this. Maybe we can't apply them in the United States, but are they worse off having Theresa May rather than David Cameron? We'll see, but probably not. Probably not.
I mean, there does seem to be, Tom Dudzik, a kind of tradition of falling on your sword at appropriate moments in Great Britain and in other countries that just doesn't exist here, right? I mean, the model is cling to the very last minute.
Well, yeah, yes, exactly. And that's you know, from a nation that gave us Monty Python. So there's, you know, the closest I get to politics in Britain is watching Liverpool play football.
Although, although Kalilah, I did note that there was sort of a whiff of some of the gender politics that we have here in the United States. In fact, one of the ways that the Brits accomplish this, of course, is that in a very short period of time, everybody else shoots themselves in the foot until there's only one person who isn't hopping on one foot, and that person gets to be prime minister. And that seems to have happened here. But I mean, one of the other potential contenders for this post, another woman, had suggested over the weekend that she would be a better prime minister because she's a mother, and Theresa May is not. And that got her out of the race, mm-hmm. you know, pretty quickly, which once again sort of suggests that the understanding in Great Britain about what's in bounds and what's out of bounds is pretty well worked out.
It's very clear. It's very well established. I think we play with the lines all the time here in the U.S. But I think it's also interesting that a woman inherits that position at a time when the country is in political chaos, kind of like when we elected our first African-American president in the U.S., right? You inherit the job that no one else wants. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, plenty of people wanted to be prime minister in there. They're all hobbling around today, acting like they're happy for Theresa May. But they, just on the on that interview that was this week. It was published this week, this past mm-hmm. weekend, in the Times of London, and the Andrea Leadsom, who was the candidate who mm-hmm. made those remarks, first said, "Oh, it was taken out of context. It's terrible. It's outrageous." Then the newspaper released the audio recording of it, and it was not taken out of context. It's exactly what she said and emphasized. And then she texted her apology to Theresa May, and then
well, she's busy with her kids. She doesn't have time. She doesn't have time. She's got her kids are driving her crazy.
Made,
she
they
can't.
Made plenty of sport about her devotion to making a Sunday roast for her children.
Yeah,
each
she
week.
Doesn't have time to go apologize in person. We've got just a couple of minutes left here, so we can maybe have a moment to swing back to politics. In the always exciting Second District, Larry Kudlow the other day endorsed Daria Novak, who's the Republican challenging Joe Courtney. Since we're doing Britain, Kevin, I was reminded.
Sorry,
Kevin, I was reminded
what is
of
the matter with Larry Kudlow.
Of Oscar Wilde's description of fox hunting, the inedible in full pursuit, excuse me, the unspeakable in full pursuit of the inedible. But also Jonathan Pelto, Tom Dudzik, Jonathan Pelto is back. He's going to run as a Green Party candidate against Joe Courtney, whom he professes to admire.
He says he loves Joe Courtney. I guess there's some unfinished business Jonathan needs to do. He says his campaign is going to be about bringing issues that no one else is going to talk about. So stay tuned for that one. But I also think it's a kind of effort to keep the Green Party as a minority party. I think you have to get a certain percentage of the vote each year, and absent that, there goes the Green Party. So I think this is his effort to keep things alive.
But Kalilah, I think you'll also see a little bit more of this in general because of at the top of the ticket, the dissatisfaction with the national choices. We may see more down ticket activity with third parties just because people feel that there is that kind of vacuum.
And I think that is the benefit, again, of this year's primaries, that it made people look at the structure, look at the system to say, why aren't these voices emerging? You know, when Bernie Sanders gave that speech a couple of weeks ago, he encouraged his supporters to run for political office at the local and state level. And what we see is that those are the levels that people can really have an impact on the day-to-day operations of government and politics. I think in this case, more competition is always a good thing.
I want to give Kevin and Tom just a quick minute to say goodbye to Mary Fritz. She was a state representative. She died over the weekend at the age of 78 after a year-long battle with cancer. She served one term in the early 1980s, then returned to office in 86, where she served for the next 30 years. We've only got about 30 or 40 seconds left, which is not enough, Kevin, but I'm sure you did overlap with her, right?
I did. Just a fine legislator who was there for all the right reasons for a long time, a good person.
And Tom?
Yeah, no, I'll certainly echo that, and I think that kind of trait is kind of, you know, well missing in politics today. She's a classy woman who everyone loved her.
All right. Thank you, Tucker Rives, for getting the show together today. And thanks to Jonathan McPants, who's on the board, and all of our wonderful interns as well. I'm going to be back at 1 o'clock with a show about Westerns, and particularly the pull that Westerns exert on our culture, our politics, our understanding of how you get things done in this country.